From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author David Goodwillie, whose new novel is Kings County, published by Avid Reader Press. David Goodwillie is the author of the novel American Subversive, a New York Times notable book of the year, and the memoir seemed like a good idea at the time. He has written for the New York Times, New York Magazine, Newsweek, and Popular Science, among other publications. He has also been drafted to play professional baseball, worked as a private investigator, and was an expert at Sotheby's Auction House. A graduate of Kenyon College, he lives in Brooklyn. Here's a little information about Kings County. It's the early 2000s, and like generations of ambitious young people before her, Audrey Benton arrives in New York City on a bus from nowhere. Broke, but resourceful, she soon finds a home for herself amid the burgeoning music scene in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. But the city's freedom comes with risks, and Audrey makes compromises to survive. As she becomes a minor celebrity in indie rock circles, she finds an unlikely match in Theo Gorski, a shy but idealistic Milltown kid who's struggling to establish himself in the still patrician world of books. But then an old acquaintance of Audrey's disappears under mysterious circumstances, sparking a series of escalating crises that force the couple to confront a dangerous secret from her past. From the raucous heights of Occupy Wall Street to the comical lows of the publishing industry, from million-dollar art auctions to Bushwick drug dens, Kings County captures New York City at a moment of cultural reckoning. I hope you will enjoy my conversation with David Goodwillie, with whom I spoke by phone last week. So it's not an exciting first question, but I really do want to know how the book started for you, because there's so much going on. There's like the music scene, the place, the characters, and then this kind of embedded mystery. So what was the initial idea for it?
I very much started Kings County with an idea of two characters, Audrey Benton and Theo Gorski,
right?
Who just came to me almost fully formed. It's my third book, and I'm one of those writers who doesn't worry too much about plot in the beginning. I feel like if I know who the characters are and I feel strongly about them, that the plot will come as they start to move through the world, at least in my mind and then on the page. So it very much, my previous book was called American Subversive, and it was a bit plottier, and I wanted to write a much more character-driven book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started with these two characters who've moved to New York from elsewhere in the country in a kind of age-old follow-your-dreams way, and they've made sacrifices to get there, and I knew once I had them geographically where I wanted them to be, which was Williamsburg in the early 2000s, where there's this incredible kind of art and music scene happening,
right,
that things would happen to them. So that was the genesis of the book, and it pretty much became that book. I do tend to write, you know, I like plot too. I want my readers to turn the pages, but I didn't force that on myself. Like, I knew that would happen as I got going in the book.
Yeah.
I don't ever know what the end of the book is going to be when I start it, which is, every writer is very different in how they approach a book. It's such a huge process that takes years. And some writers, you know, diagram things out and have exact page numbers for each chapter. Other writers kind of are a bit more free flowing.
Right.
And I am one of those writers where I know it's going to come, but I don't stress out and worry about it when I'm writing chapter one.
So the thing that occurs to me about that, because I'm more, when I write, I'm more like you, and it takes me a long time. So it takes years for probably everybody, but I feel like the people that plan ahead, maybe it takes 1 or 2 years, and some people that don't plan ahead, it takes a lot longer. How long did it take you to write Kings County? I'm just curious.
It took me 7 years.
And
probably 4 or 5 years of writing and 2 years of editing and for it to come out, et cetera. But I started it, I think, 2013, and it's published here in the summer of 2020. So
Yeah.
It was a long haul. It's a long book, and it was longer when I handed it in to my editor.
I have a question about that.
Yeah, but it was, my two other books probably took 2-3 years each. This book was, I struggled with it for a long time in terms of how I wanted to write it, the mechanics of writing flashbacks and, present day stuff and how, it just was a lot of stuff. There's a lot going on in the book, obviously, that we'll probably talk about a bit. But it did take a while. I also write journalism, so some of that stuff, some of that time was writing other stuff, but the book was always forefront of my mind and I was always working on it during that time.
Yeah. Okay, great. I love Audrey and Theo's relationship. And I thought you did a great job really from the start in introducing us to them. One early clue that they were going to be a fun couple was the first line game that they play early on in the book. They trade potential opening lines to a novel, and they make it something of a competition. And it made me wonder why you didn't actually start the book with "the drummer wanted a mind eraser." I was like, why didn't he do that?
I know. I think I ended the first chapter with that line. I would say that you can probably tell as you read the book. The book is a love story, and always in my mind, no matter what the plot was going to be, it was going to be a story of these two characters who, when you start the book, they're deeply in love and things are going right for them and things are going to unravel throughout the book. And they unravel because of the plot. But in my mind, that love story is still the central part of the book. And it's very important to get the reader latched onto these two characters, to have the reader really caring about these characters a great deal before the plot starts to really unfold. And especially the early chapters, it's really just about them and getting to know them. I mean, things are happening, obviously, but I really wanted to take a deep dive into who these two people were and have those little games that couples have between them and make the reader feel that they can relate in that way. I mean, that's what a relationship is. That's what couples do, is silly little things that keeps a relationship fresh. Why not put that on the page? Take the time as the writer to make these, make these couples kind of fleshed out a bit.
Yeah. And I should say, just to kind of explain that sentence, they're in a bar and Theo offers to get drinks for everybody. And the drummer in the band that Audrey works with wants a drink that's called a mind eraser. And so he goes to the bar thinking the drummer wanted a mind eraser. That's a good opening line for a book. So that's where that came from. That was really fun.
That's right. And that first chapter is actually, I always kind of challenge myself to write scenes I haven't written in previous books. And it's for sanity wise, it's not always the greatest idea, but I like to it keeps writing fresh for me. And I've never written a big scene starting off a book, a kind of a big party scene where you have all these people moving around a room and you have to introduce the characters. You have to introduce the plot. You have to, there has to be suspense right off the bat. I've always loved reading those scenes in other novels, even as I've realized they're probably very hard to write. But when it's done well, it can bring a reader right into a book really quickly. And so I thought that would be a great scene to write, especially with a New York story like Kings County, to have this kind of club scene and it's chaotic and, different people have different kind of ideas of what they're trying to do. And how they're relating to each other. And there's three or four things going on simultaneously. And I thought it would be a really cool way if I could pull it off to open a book. At the same time, I wanted to slow down a bit too. So that first chapter alternates between Audrey and Theo. And in Audrey's parts, it's kind of chaos. And she's a band manager and she's trying to deal with her band and her friends and getting everybody settled in this chaotic, terrible New York City club. And then Theo, who, I want you to learn a lot about who he is. So there's 4 or 5 pages of him just trying to order a drink at a bar. In the middle of this club and move through a crowded bar and how, if you're a New Yorker, how annoying that can be to just try to do the simplest task, but just be stymied. Just trying to do a nice thing and get a round of drinks for people. And I thought that, that would be a great kind of juxtaposition to the chaos of the club to have you having, you know, to have a character having this interior monologue, just trying to order a drink.
Yeah. And it's funny because I'm juggling something now where I'm trying to introduce a lot of characters at the beginning of a book. And it reminded me when I was reading that scene, just like the chaos, you did that so well and it didn't knock me out of the book, but there is a lot going on. And what do you think is good advice for sort of like containing chaos, but conveying it at the same time? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You have to have the right mix of dialogue and exposition. I think you can't have all dialogue. It can get really confusing who's saying what, if you have a lot of characters, and crosstalk. And to me as a reader, I don't love that. So you do have to have an exposition. You have to, you got to grab the reader, but you got to, slow down a bit too in places.
Right.
And so there are longer descriptive scenes in that opening chapter too, where I'm describing the band that is there, and I'm describing what New York is in that moment a bit through different characters' eyes. And, it takes you a little bit out of the scene. You don't want all scene. I mean, it's not a screenplay. Like it's a novel, and you just have to, and it's kind of instinctual, I think, as a writer, that kind of relationship between being in scene, like writing this dialogue, and pulling out a bit and giving novel a chance to breathe.
Right. And I think probably having Theo go off on his own, he's part of the chaos, but he's very much on his own. He can't get a bartender's attention. And so that gives us his narrative perspective to kind of calm down in and be a part of. And I think that probably helped a lot.
Yeah. And he and just who he is, there's a genuine kind of issue with the scene he's in. He's in this club. He's the last guy who would be in a club like this.
Right.
And he hates this kind of thing, but he loves Audrey so much, and it is Audrey's world. And so he'll be there because she's there and it's important to her. But he's struggling, and he struggles with so much that is kind of, it is the world around him. He's a thinker. He's somebody who is, a contemplative guy. And sometimes New York is not a contemplative place. Sometimes New York is kind of hitting you on the head with stuff.
Yeah.
And he has to, throughout the book, he has to deal with that kind of push and pull.
You just said something that made me smile, because you said he's the last guy who would be in a club like this. And that's the opening line from Bright Lights, Big City. Do you remember that book?
I just realized that as I was saying it. Almost word for word, the opening line of Bright Lights, Big City. It's been a while, but character is much more comfortable in a club, as I remember.
Yeah, he was. Let's see. I wanted to ask you, David, about describing the music scene for readers who might not have any background in that, without getting bogged down in that or any other sort of overarching descriptive moment. It's all very easy to read and it's informative without being overly detailed.
Yeah. I lived in New York. I've lived here since the late 90s. And obviously I have an interest in the arts. I love reading. I love writing, but I also love music. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a musician. I've always just been an appreciator. And starting in the early 2000s, it became very clear to me, a lot of people who love music, that there was something going on. I was living in downtown Manhattan at the time, but it's not hard to get across the river to Brooklyn. And there was a scene developing in the neighborhoods of Williamsburg, Greenpoint, Bushwick, where all these bands were living in close proximity to each other, mm-hmm. and all becoming very famous. Bands like The Strokes and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and TV on the Radio and Interpol and all these bands that just, were blowing up nationwide. We're all living within 5-10 blocks of each other, and a real geographic scene was taking place.
Right.
And it was incredibly cool to watch and to read about and to go see these bands play. And I started thinking I would maybe write about this someday, because I had a kind of healthy distance from it. I wasn't in that scene, but I would go see the music. And sure enough, years later, I put these characters in that world, because it seemed to me that those things don't happen too much in America, where you have a geographic artistic movement happening. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was probably like once a decade, maybe, the 60s in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury and all that, the 70s in LA and Laurel Canyon and that kind of sound that came out of there. In the 80s in Detroit, there was a huge music movement. The 90s in Seattle with Nirvana and all that. And the 2000s in Brooklyn. And it only lasted 8 or 10 years, because by 2010, 2011, hip hop was kind of taking over and indie music was dying down. But it was a definitive, like, exciting scene and place to be. And I think it heightens the book to have these characters land in New York in the middle of that. And especially Audrey, who works at a small indie record label, she's very much in the middle of that. And it just, it's a cool way to write a book, because it makes it exciting and it makes these characters kind of historical in a way, to have them be running around in that world.
Right. Now, you have a pretty eclectic background, and I wanted to just ask you about that. You were drafted to play professional baseball, you've been a private investigator, and you were an expert at Sotheby's Auction House, which I'm guessing served you well as you wrote Kings County. So let's start there. What were you an expert at, or what does that mean for what you were doing?
I was an expert in their sports and collectibles department, because I had a bit of a sports background. I moved to New York when I was 23, having had a short-lived baseball career, and I had vague ideas of being a writer, but I wasn't from an artsy family. Nobody in my family was even a big reader, really.
Like Theo.
Exactly. I struggled for a while to figure out how to be in the arts, and so I always had to have a real job. So I didn't really write anything till I was 30 or so. But the real jobs I had along the way were like just crazy, ridiculous jobs that sounded fun and ended up being pretty fun. I was a private investigator for Kroll Associates, which is the world's largest investigative agency. And it's kind of, it's not like following cheating spouses around. It's like following money around the world a bit, and like kind of high level corporate investigations. And I was always running around the city trying to, like, you know, find the underbelly of things. And then I worked at Sotheby's, which is the world's largest auction house, as their sports expert, because I kind of had this baseball background. I rode the dot-com boom up and down. And then I was like 30, 31 years old, and I realized I hadn't written anything, but there was something keeping me, you know, tethered to the literary world. I read, you know, I read everything I could read, and I would go to readings by myself, and I would go to this place called Cafe Loop down in the Village where all the writers and agents hung out. And it wouldn't leave me. It just stuck with me. And so I realized, I looked around and I said, I just had this really strange 10 years of living in New York. Maybe I don't have the confidence or know how to write a novel yet, but maybe I can write a memoir about what it is to be young and confused, and and it'll be episodic, obviously, but the jobs are so interesting in and of themselves, it might be fun to read about. And I really had no idea what I was doing. I got a room at the Chelsea Hotel, where I wrote a lot of it, and just started writing. And it took 2 years, and somehow I produced a readable memoir. It was called Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time, and it came out with Algonquin Books in 2006. And all of a sudden I was a writer, and I was like, I looked around, I'm like, my gosh, I need to write another one. This is what I do now. But unless you're David Sedaris, I don't think memoir after memoir is, you know, necessarily the best way to go. And kind of, you know, if you want to be a literary writer, the novel is the gold standard. So, I started writing a novel, and, now I'm 3 books in, and it's very much what I do for a living. But it was a struggle for a long time, not just the writing itself, which is always a struggle, but allowing myself to do it, allowing myself to say, okay, this is, living an artistic life is okay to do. I don't need to, I'm just not a person who is going to put a suit on and go to work every day and be happy. I guess allowing yourself to realize that, and then to kind of change paths and actually try to do that is, it can be difficult. And it takes time sometimes, to do that and to become a different kind of, move through the world a bit differently.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I want to get back to Kings County. Really, this is a tiny thing, but I did want to ask you about the actual physical layout, not the structure, which I have a question about later, but like your chapters sometimes have numbers and sometimes have titles. Sometimes the years are mentioned when we go back in time. I just wondered if that happened at the publication level or had you decided that while you were writing the book?
So Kings County takes place in 2011, the actual story of it. But there are flashbacks with Audrey and Theo starting 10 years before that that explains their journey to get to New York City and also explains some of the backstory that ends up being the plot.
Right.
And part of Audrey's past comes back to haunt her in a very bad way.
Right.
And threatens their relationship and actually threatens their lives. And I thought about how to write that structure for a long time, because you're kind of taught to not have a lot of backstory in a novel, and you kind of, you know, you need to keep the thing going. You need to keep a reader turning pages, and backstory traditionally kind of, you know, brings that to a grinding halt sometimes. I tend to not worry about kind of writing edicts like that. And I knew I would have a lot of backstory, but if I could make the backstory really interesting, nobody would care, right? If the backstory itself is a mystery, who would care? So, but I also, because it's, there's actually four different narrators in the book. It's third person, but you're in four different heads, because there's a second couple, that are friends with Audrey and Theo that are kind of, you know, play the couples off each other somewhat,
yep.
Chris and Sarah. And so it's a bit complex in terms of who's talking sometimes. And if you're going to have backstory as well, I did want to give the reader an idea of, okay, this is a chapter that is backstory. And so those chapters are dated,
yeah.
And actually like a, you know, a timeline too, and dated. And, it says geographically where they are. And in that way, you kind of can mentally adjust. Audrey's from Cape Canaveral, Florida. And she grows up in a trailer park there and basically watches space shuttles and rockets take off. And, she's, you know, she's very poor. She lives with her grandmother. Her parents are gone. And, you know, she dreams of a bigger life. It's, a kind of an interesting childhood she's had and an interesting time through high school and college. And it's very clear that she needs to get out of there and she needs to give herself permission to leave and start her own life. Theo is from a mill town in Massachusetts, Lawrence, Massachusetts, and his, you know, generation after generation has worked at the same factory there in the Merrimack Valley, and he falls in love with books, and he finds a very different way out through, you know, going to financial aid, going to college, and getting to New York that way, and he wants to break into the world of books, which is still a very old world patrician industry, and he's not of that moneyed background, and he has a lot of trouble breaking through. But these two characters, that whole backstory leads up through the years to 2011 and meets kind of right in the middle of the book.
Yep.
And after that, the second half of the book, there's no backstory. It all takes place in the present,
Yeah.
And actually the present tense as well. I switched tenses at that point too. So it is like, I wouldn't say it's like complicated and difficult to read, but there's a lot going on with the structure. And it took me a long time to figure out how to do that in a hopefully seamless way.
Right.
You know, hopefully I pulled it off.
I definitely think you pulled it off. And it's funny because I did want to talk about that. I seem to be asking a lot of people lately about handling transitions, and I thought you did a really good job of handling transitions into backstory or into the next scene or into the next chapter. But I thought one of the things that made it work was I was feeling so drawn to both of these characters, and I felt like you introduced us first to Audrey, then to Theo, and then you gave us Audrey through Theo's point of view. You gave us Theo through Audrey's point of view. Then you gave us their backstories. So by the time we get into what you're calling sort of the present tense of the story, I was really immersed in their lives and really attached to them as a reader. And I thought you did that really well.
Great. Yeah, it is very much a character-driven kind of book throughout. But I didn't mind taking the time to have the reader get to know these two, or really four of them,
right?
Dropping breadcrumbs for the first few chapters in terms of, you know, something is going to happen to them and it's not going to be good. And there are these little clues right from the beginning along the way. A friend of theirs goes missing, but you know, there's so little information in the beginning, and each chapter builds on suspense-wise on something that was laid there before. But at the same time, you're really, I do take the time to let the novel breathe, to let you know where they live and what they're doing and what the larger city is and how they see that city. There's so much going on in that moment in New York. There's Occupy Wall Street. There's all these things that are making Theo and Audrey, you know, they're at this crucial age in their early 30s where there's, you know, everyone's always trying to figure it out, but you're really trying to figure it out when you're in that age. And, you know, neither of them have been in a relationship like this, and it can be overwhelming. And, you know, all this that in real life you deal with, and I want readers to be able to really relate to these two and to like them, because they're both likable characters, even though they've both done things that are kind of unseemly. There's reasons for that, you know, so I don't mind, you know, I always wanted to be a character driven book. I can't help but put a lot of plot in no matter what, but you know, there's this, I like writers myself. And I think that writers tend to write a bit like, you know, the books that they really enjoy reading.
Yeah.
And I like those books that are very literary and very character driven, but also have a plot, also make you turn the pages.
And so when you're moving from one part of your book into another part, whether it be backstory or a scene or a chapter, do you have any thoughts about how you handle transitions, like getting from one place to the other?
Sure. Everyone kind of has, I actually thought about it in a mechanical way, which is very different than I usually do in terms of like stage time, really, in terms of like, maybe Audrey and Theo, because they're obviously the most important part of the book, would have double the amount of time that, in terms of, you know, whose head you're inside, than the other couple. But and you know, maybe, you know, right down to how many chapters there are that each person gets, kind of. And that's kind of the first draft of the book I handed into my editor, and there were, you know, he looked at it and he's like, the reader's not going to care that, you know, there are six chapters exactly that this person is in five, you know, like, so I was like, you know what? You're right. Nobody's going to notice that. And so I went back and reshuffled the deck a bit and made it a bit more flowing in terms of, who gets to, you know, who says what and how the story is built. In terms of transitions, I think it's still very important to finish a chapter on a kind of suspenseful note.
Mm-hmm.
And the reader is going to turn the page, and if they're immersed in the story, gladly begin another chapter, even if it's another character picking up on a story, because each character, you're building one story, but each character plays a different part in that story and has a different viewpoint of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you're building that one story brick by brick, brick by brick, then you've got the reader hooked, I think.
Okay.
And they're not going to care who's telling that story necessarily.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned sort of dropping tidbits, and I wanted to talk about that because, like, early on, chapter one, you set the scene and the people, and then you sort of explode everything with this rumor of somebody that's a stranger to the reader who maybe has died. And we know right away that Audrey is affected by this. Okay, so that is right away. And then it's something like 50 to 80 pages later that we first get the first tidbit of more. And if you don't mind my reading a couple sentences.
Sure.
This is from Audrey's point of view. As far as she knew, the other people involved, Sarah, Chris, and Fender, had never told another soul what they'd done. Occasionally, in the months afterward, she would hear a crazy rumor, third or fourth hand, but it was never that close to the truth. So we have that, and we're like, what is she talking about? But then we don't get anything for a little while again. And it's like very enticing, I thought.
Oh, thank you. I want a reader to keep reading. I mean, suspense is still, no matter what kind of book you're writing, suspense is still lies at the heart of a book, or it should. I also was playing with this idea of, and this is especially if you live in a place like New York and you're meeting people all the time, this idea of never quite knowing what is going on sometimes with a person. And hearing rumors and, you know, or kind of asides at a party or something, and not knowing if they're true, and you don't hear it again for a while, and you kind of are left with, you're left hanging in terms of a story or who a person is. And in that first chapter, the rumor she hears is texted to another character. Nobody knows where it's coming from, if it's true, but if it is true, it's going to deeply affect her life.
Yeah.
But she can't figure out if it is, whether it's somebody just misspoke, or the name is wrong. You know, it's just this thing that's out there, and that happens in real life where you can't get all the details sometimes. And also in New York, especially, or in a city, you're young and you meet somebody at a party and you kind of are yapping about something and you get to know them. Maybe you see them 3 months later again, and and by the third time you see them, you're supposed to know them, but you don't really know anything about them. You don't really know sometimes what their last name is or what they do, but you've seen them three times and had three conversations, and you're supposed to know them. And that happens all the time.
Sure.
In my life. And I wanted to play off these ideas that, like, sometimes you don't know the full story. And that seemed to me a very good way to add suspense and drama to this situation. This character at the middle of all of this is a guy named Fender. Nobody really knows his last name. He's been kind of, you know, in Williamsburg is kind of a famous, you know, he's just omnipresent for years in everybody's life, but nobody really knows about him. And I know people like that from my years in New York who just pop up here and there. And they're great and they're fun and a good time. Charlie's great to hang out with, but you don't really know their backstory at all. And that's always been interesting to me, is to put a character like that at the center of a mystery in a book.
Yeah. He was very interesting, you know, and just sort of, even his name, you know, it's like, it's this name that says, there's more story here than I'm giving you, you know?
Very much so. And nobody even knows if that's his name. He kind of works in music and his name is Fender. And,
right.
You know, the characters are like, is that a coincidence? Is that possible that that's his actual name? Like, nobody really knows. But also, life moves fast and nobody really cares. And nobody stops to think to ask ever.
Right.
You know, he's just this character. And it just fits him. And of course, when things start to unravel and people have questions, they don't have the answers that they should have gotten years ago.
Yeah. Let's see. I think one of the things that is really fun in reading fiction, or maybe any prose, is the contradictions that seem to kind of like offer more and defy cliche. And so, for example, Theo has abundant physicality, as you put it. He's very big. He's a big, big guy. He looks like a big old football player. Not old, but, you know, big football player guy. But he is modest and unassuming. And that is conveyed throughout. But that's how you describe him early on. Another contradiction like this is Sarah, the character Sarah. Audrey considers how Sarah had never been cheap when she had no money. So it's like these little moments that just sort of say, this person is one thing, but is also this other thing. Or this person is one thing, and so you might draw conclusions, but it's not correct. There's a contradiction there. I just love those little paradoxes and how they help to kind of build interesting characters. Do you go back through and try to add that sort of stuff, or does that sort of just come naturally as you're working?
Yeah, I'm always worried about the stock character, right? And creating somebody who's just a bit too, cliched in some way.
Predictable.
Predictable. And I think I naturally try to make people nuanced and have those contradictions in somebody's personality, because of course in real life we all have them.
Right.
For instance, there's a banker in the book named Chris.
Yeah.
And of course, if you have all these kind of kids in the arts running around in a book, and then you have a banker who's a, you know, straight white male, you're kind of thinking, oh, well, this guy's going to be a certain type of person. And in some ways I do, want him to be that certain type of person. But in a lot of other ways, he's a very likable guy and a very nuanced guy, and he plays a big part in the plot. And sometimes I want a reader to, when a character is introduced, to think a certain thing, and then I want to turn it around on the reader. And I think, you know, it keeps people on their toes as they're going through the book. But it is something that I think every writer should worry about a bit, is, you know, having a character that's too predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure that they create character traits that kind of, you know, blow that up a bit and keep somebody very interesting. Because if you keep a character, you know, on their toes, it's going to keep a reader on their toes too.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is maybe almost a little bit related, because you just mentioned Chris, and I the first scene with Chris, he's actually watching porn at work. Or no, he's not watching porn. He's interacting with, like,
A cam girl,
right? Yeah. So I have to admit, it took me a little while to get past that. But anyway, so I want to talk about depicting racism, such as Theo's recollection of his family's outlook on race, or particularly his father's outlook on race, I think it was, in a time like now with Black Lives Matter, or depicting sexism and sexual violence in a time of Me Too. I feel like honest depiction is so important in fiction and in what we present in the written word. But it's somehow become very controversial, triggering. You know, people don't want there to be too much triggering stuff in the work. And I have really mixed feelings about this, and I'm wondering what you think about this.
Yeah, it's a very difficult topic right now, especially if you're writing, you know, scenes of, you know, sexual assault, and you're writing about characters that obviously aren't from your personal background.
Right.
And there are both of those in this book. And I approach it in a way that if I'm going to, as a male, write a female character where something as traumatic is happening to her, I do think I'm allowed to do that, because that is what the root of fiction is. Nobody mm-hmm. wants a straight white male to write a bunch of straight white characters a la John Cheever in, you know, 1978. Like, that world is no longer in existence. And
right.
Good. At the same time, you have to be extremely sensitive to what you're writing if you're going to go in that direction. And so, for instance, there are things that happen to Audrey in the story.
Right.
And that I don't, you know, I don't kind of, you know, put the brakes on. I really write those scenes. But what I did as I wrote them and after is I have a network of who I consider extremely smart and female novelists who are know how to give notes and who I trust.
Right.
And so something like that, I will, you know, scenes like that, I will have a woman or several women in this case read and ask if I got it right, if there are things that a woman would think or react to that as a guy I haven't thought through.
Mm-hmm.
And there very much were in this. And it's not the the scenes itself, it's almost the aftermath of how Audrey would react to what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't given that enough attention. And I, my friends thought that I should explore that more and get deeper into the trauma of how Audrey would live with what would happen to her afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about that a great deal, and the book changed a great deal because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can handle things sensitively like that and intelligently, it's okay to write about them.
Yeah.
At the same time, I don't think that, like, anybody can write about anything. I don't think I should be writing a Pakistani immigrant story about coming to America. Like, that's just not my experience in the world.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And maybe I shouldn't be tackling material like that. But, you know, most of the time these days, it's, you know, writers are smart enough to know where the boundaries are a bit and what they're comfortable writing. But at the same time, I don't want to shy away from writing difficult stuff, writing a character who is, you know, like Theo's dad, who is a racist, who's an old union guy that sees the world in a certain way,
right,
and says it just out loud. This is who I am, because you learn from that. Like that, you know, you, if you have a character like that, it doesn't mean that the book is racist, or it means
right.
the character is racist, and you're actually learning how, you know, how complicated the world is, and how these characters' backgrounds, how their sons kind of see who the fathers are and their relatives, and have to, how the journey Theo has to take to not be his father. But you have to show who his father is to show how Theo is different than his father. And that stuff is sometimes difficult to read, and it can be triggering, but it's also, if you don't write it in a certain way, suddenly the book isn't as honest as it should be.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it is a very difficult, it's a minefield these days. I do think overall that the world of literary fiction is a lot more interesting than it's ever been. There are a ton of amazing voices that you weren't hearing from 20 years ago and 10 years ago, and that are an absolute pleasure to read. It's getting more and more diverse, maybe not as quickly as it should be. And the publishing world itself is getting more diverse, a bit slower than the writers are. But, I think that, you know, we're talking about Jay McInerney, the world of Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McInerney, and in some ways, Don Updike and Philip Roth is kind of, it's changed a great deal, and in some ways for the better.
Okay, great. Well, now we're talking about other books. So I did want to ask you, David, what you've been reading lately that you've particularly enjoyed that you might recommend to listeners.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, there's so many good books. I go back and forth between reading fiction and nonfiction all the time. Sometimes if I'm writing a lot of fiction, I want to read a lot of nonfiction stuff I'm not kind of working on. So this earlier this year, when I was doing final edits on this book, I read a great memoir by a woman named Stephanie Danler called Stray. And Stephanie wrote a fantastic novel called Bittersweet a few years ago that got turned into a TV show about her life and kind of working in the Union Square Cafe, a famous restaurant in New York, and she novelized basically a memoir. It was a beautiful book. This is her second book. It's a real memoir, and it is just haunting and devastating and beautiful, and it's one of my favorite books of the year.
Okay, great.
Early on in the pandemic, I read a book called Severance, which is actually about a kind of a dystopian novel about a pandemic, and then I loved it, but then I realized I probably didn't need to be reading a lot of dystopian pandemic books during a dystopian pandemic.
Okay, great. Wonderful. How about what you're working on next? Do you have a project started, or do you know what you're going to be doing next?
I do. I'm kind of one of those writers. And again, every writer is so different in terms of habits, in terms of how they work on stuff. I am not one of these writers that finishes a book and the next day kind of cracks their knuckles and gets at the next one.
Yeah.
I can't wait to dive in. I'm very much a writer. I have no idea what to write, and I'm somewhat exhausted after I've finished a book and, you know, done the press for it. And I have to like be in the world a bit before I can figure out what I want to write next. It takes me a long time to write a book. You know, it's something I take very seriously, obviously. And, you know, sometimes it can take a year or 2 years for me to really latch on to something, latch on to characters that I can see spending years with, finding a story and a setting that I haven't, you know, explored yet. And so I am in that process. I'm kind of researching a few things. I tend to write about what bothers me in the world. And so, you know, it can be as simple as my previous book, American Subversive, was kind of very political and followed a bunch of young lefty radicals around, kind of a la the Weather Underground, but for the, you know, contemporary America. And then I said to myself, okay, I've done my political book. Now I want to write about love. And that's what Kings County is, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a kind of epic love story. And now I've written my kind of love book, and I want to write about something else. And I think I want to write about money. So how do you make, because it's just makes the world go around, for better or worse, often for worse. So I want to write about how money affects characters, and find a world where I can make a story about something bland, incredibly interesting and involving. And I set challenges like that up for myself, and sometimes I think it's, you know, maybe not the best way to go about something, but it keeps me engaged for the years it takes to write a book. If I'm writing about something that really bothers me in the real world or something I want to explore, writers are great at asking questions and not so good at providing answers. But if the questions are interesting and it makes an interesting book, I think that that's fine. And sometimes a reader doesn't need all the answers. So to me, I'm just getting interested in a kind of area. And I have to figure out what that story would be.
Okay. All right. That's great. Now we've come to the part where I would read a little bit of your book and then ask you a question. Is that okay if I read?
Absolutely.
Basically, sure. It's a paragraph in the, a little past the middle of the book. And I'll just say that Audrey is not in a good emotional place in this scene. Audrey chained her 10-speed to a no-parking sign directly across Union Avenue from the colorless bunker that housed the 19th precinct. What an unsightly structure, to say nothing of the surrounding neighborhood. She was still in Williamsburg, though it felt as far from Bedford Avenue as Benton Harbor. Everything around her seemed made of concrete, from the high-rise housing projects to the dark blocks of Hasidic apartment buildings, their cage-like balconies, a too obvious metaphor for the hermetic beliefs of those who lived inside. The bridge was somewhere nearby, and the Navy Yard, and the infamous Marcy houses, but all Audrey could see was urban gloom stretching off in every direction. So much of Kings County is about Brooklyn. We've talked a lot about the romance, the love story between Audrey and Theo, but I do want to touch on setting, because there's just so much beautiful description of Brooklyn, the different areas of Brooklyn, but also, you know, I mean, describing this place, which she's finding very ugly, is very interesting at this point in the novel. So I wonder if you want to just talk a little bit about writing setting.
Sure, absolutely. You know, there are four characters in this book, but there are really five, and New York City is just, kind of front and center the whole book.
Right.
Whether it is just a dingy underground basement of a club in the middle of nowhere, or, you know, a high-rise tower where financiers work, or, the Occupy protests, or a single person walking down the street looking up and imagining the city, and it's just omnipresent. And I have lived in the city for 24 years now, something like that, and I still find it a fascinating place to be, and I still get so much energy from it, and I just love it. I never get tired of it, and I just think it's fascinating to write about. The part of Brooklyn where I live is in Greenpoint, and Williamsburg is, you know, it's filled with kind of hip young kids who have moved here. It's full of old Italian and Polish neighborhoods. It's full of Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. And these are separate little enclaves, but we all just kind of flow together in the same world too. And I love to bring that out, and I love to kind of it's so beautiful sometimes to see, and it's so beautiful to write about. And there are parts of this book where something, you know, crazy has happened to a character, and the next chapter starts off with somebody just taking, like, walking.
Mm-hmm.
And clearing. You know, Theo has this whole chapter where he just basically walks from his apartment after something traumatic has happened to the Occupy protests. And it's a 3 or 4 hour walk. I mean, it doesn't take that long to read it, but it's, you know, and he's just looking at the city and wondering if this is the place he should be, because so much of it is beautiful, but so much of it is devastating too, physically. And, I like to play with, you know, issues like gentrification, which is kind of also omnipresent throughout the book, and having characters in uncomfortable places physically. It's something that I can't help but write about, is New York City. In a scene like you just read, where it's kind of a doom and gloom thing.
Yeah.
I like you know, Audrey is actually in a very difficult spot. She's about to walk into a police precinct,
right.
And a lot of stuff has just happened to her.
Yep.
And so in some ways, she's seeing a doom and gloom city because of her mindset at that moment.
Right.
And so those are things that, you know, whereas if it was a different situation, she might be standing on the exact same corner and seeing sun and brightness.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are ways that you can, by a character describing a landscape in a certain way, you can kind of set up what's going to happen next, even though she's not thinking about, you know, that's not about the police precinct. It's not about the mystery in the story. It's just about what she's looking at in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful way to kind of build a tension or drama sometimes in a novel, is just to basically, you know, describe what the character sees around them in a certain way.
Great.
Anyway, so I love playing with setting and with geography and with physical space, and I don't mind taking the time to describe something, whether it's a city block or whether it's a outfit a character's wearing. I always feel like that kind of adds to a scene a great deal.
Okay, wonderful. I just have one last question for you, and I like to end these interviews asking for advice for other writers. And in your case, you know, in particular, because you've already mentioned that you're not a planner, but I, you know, I too love a good plot within a literary novel, and I feel like you have really done that. You've created a literary novel that became a page turner somewhere around page 10. So, you know, I want to know if you have any advice for plotting, even if you're not a planner.
Yeah. It's not, again, it's not something that you should, or a writer should, freak out about from page one. I don't think so many, I know writers who have these huge pieces of paper and they've got timelines and they've got, you know, all the stuff that's supposed to be happening, and inevitably you do that, and you know, very quickly the arrow starts going up or down or sideways, and it's not going to be the book that you planned, because
mm-hmm.
Characters are really living things when you're writing them, and they're just going to do stuff that surprises you. It sounds weird if you're not a writer sometimes to be talking like that, but it's so true. And that when that happens, it means something good is happening, something very genuine in the writing itself. That said, you do have to, at some point, be, you know, thinking as a suspense writer, really, and thinking about how do I keep this reader turning pages? How do I begin and end chapters? I will read stuff, you know, that, you know, stuff like Dan Brown, right? Stuff where, like, it's 3-page chapters, but I'm interested, you know, the story might be a bit, you know, commercial for me, but I'm very interested in what he's doing to keep a reader, you know, buzzing through, you know, pages like
right.
crazy, maniacally. And
right.
that's of interest to me. Suspense and mystery are very interesting to me, and every book has to have it. It's just a question of how you meet it out, like how you, what you give to a reader, the breadcrumbs that you give them. Do you kind of just push a bunch of stuff on a reader, then create another suspenseful moment and then another suspenseful moment? Or do you have one kind of, like, which is kind of what Kings County is, one mystery, but you kind of dole out breadcrumbs a bit more slowly? And that totally depends on what kind of writer you are, but you do need to have that mystery, and it does need to feel honest and feel like it is, it works with the world you've created and the characters who are moving around in that world. And it is a bit of a symphony to keep it all together. You know, in different versions of this book, you know, I feel like the character driven stuff was a bit too heavy, and then I would rework it and the plot stuff was a bit too heavy. And, you know, a lot of the editing process of this book was getting the music right, getting all of those instruments working together and sounding great by the end. And
right.
that's what a good editor helps you with, is exactly that kind of thing.
Now, I do have a question. I don't want to give anything away, but we've already mentioned that the initial kernel about Fender is the start of something that sort of creates a mystery in this novel. So when you wrote that part, where there's rumors about Fender. Did you already know what that storyline was? Was that something that came sort of later after you developed Audrey and Theo's characters pretty far? Or did you drop in Fender without knowing what it meant?
I knew that he was going to go missing. Uh-huh. And that was going to be the initial kind of dramatic tension of the plot. I don't think I knew why he was going to go missing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Sound insane, because that's actually that's the motor of the plot. I knew it was going to be something that had happened in the characters' backgrounds that was going to really challenge them as a couple, something that one of them hadn't been honest about with the other. And that was going to be a real breaking point for them. I knew that whatever was going to happen, and I always, to me, it was always about the love story. This book is about a very, one relationship, and the plot was going to serve what happened to that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And, but no, I don't think that I had the entire story until like a couple of years in.
Okay.
There's a letter in the middle of the book, a kind of an epistolary chapter that I remember writing a few years in. And as I was writing that, the whole story unfolded for me. And I knew what the end would be. But I had to write that letter. I had to discover it myself as well. And again, I'm not sure I'd have been able to do that kind of thing if it was my first book, but one thing you learn is, as you're, into your third book, is patience, and knowing that like those aha moments are going to happen if you sit there day after day writing. And when they feel true, is that's when you kind of have your book. And so it did take a while, but when it happened, I knew it was right.
Okay, wonderful. So I want to mention again, the name of the book is Kings County, a novel by David Goodwillie and published by Avid Reader Press. David, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed talking to you and reading your book.
Shelley, it was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for having me.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with David Goodwillie about his new novel, Kings County, published by Avid Reader Press. You can learn more about his work at his website, davidgoodwillie.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, David Goodwillie. Have a character go for a walk in a city, or along a country lane, or really in any place. How would that character see the world? Have him or her see it in a different way than you, the author, would. David points out that all too often we try to give characters our own traits, rather than wholly letting them be their own people. If you're having trouble building a character, this exercise in setting and perspective might really help. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. We are still in the grip of this pandemic, and a forecast from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention projects more than 200,000 coronavirus deaths in the United States by September 19th. This is a real thing. I hope you can be safe and careful during this time. Wear a mask, avoid crowds, stay 6 feet away from one another outside. It's a terrible time in our country and in the world in so many ways, including for authors. And so, as I say every week, do try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you are able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Most weeks I do get to announce the Bookworm's calendar. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.